Okay, welcome back to the second class. So, Obama was giving this speech. Did you guys realize that this is from Obama's speech? Are you just preparing for the class? Okay, so obviously he was talking about who are still marching, and he forgot to mention some important people who are still marching. So that's a graduate student who not only posts his comments on the piazza, but also comments on other people's comments on piazza. So, and obviously they deserve some sort of a recognition. So is a John Jorgensen here? Okay, you get your ice cream sandwich. Hopefully you are not, lactose intolerant.
Thank you.
So it's important to take each other seriously. You know, you're at a graduate level, and not only am I happy that people are actually started posting, but I'm also happy that in fact, you know, you are actually commenting on each other. Is a Miles Brundage there? Okay. You only posted 4 comments, he posted 8, so you only get cookies. No sense ice cream. Can you pass it on? Okay, count them. There should be 4. Okay. Okay. So let me see if I can find a way of, does anybody know how to record the show? Sorry, show. Let's do that. Start recording from the current slide. Start recording. Let's just see what happens. Okay. So what I'm going to do is, in the first 15 minutes or so, I'm always an optimist, like to think that in 15 minutes one thing and then the rest of the class large number of other things, but the first 15 minutes or so I want to complete the discussion that was supposed to be completed last week, which is basically give you some connection between this course and 471, and as well as talk a little about pendulum swings that I told you we'll talk a little about. That is actually connected also to the comments on the piazza, okay, about the 2 papers that you read. And then we will shift gears and start talking about Markov decision processes, which is the first technical topic for the course. Okay, so we were talking about the agent, and we kind of figured out the usual distinctions in terms of what makes the design of this agent hard. And then the way you wind up designing an agent, I mean, of course, you can write, you know, many different ways of conceptualizing it. This is a useful way for an AI course. This is also from Russell's textbook, for example. And so the idea is that an agent program sort of has this high-level architecture. I'm not going to go into them in any very slow sense because you may have seen something like that before. But basically, the agent sort of needs to have some way of sensing the world so that it knows what the world is like now. Okay, and then it should then decide what action should it do. Okay, but basically, all really is matters is you have sensors to sense the world, and you have effectors to change the world. Now, why are you changing the world? Presumably because you have some goals. The agent must have some goals, you know, that's why it's changing the world. Okay, and then to be able to use these goals to pick the action, it also needs a bunch of other things. In particular, I mean, in fact, this is the kind of thing we do in Intro to AI. One can actually start talking about having like a big table of all situations, cross product goals. And then, so if you are in this situation and you have this goal, then do this action. Okay, that would be the kind of an agent policy. Okay, we quickly realize that such a policy is extremely large. It doesn't fit in anything that you can possibly imagine. Okay, and so you would wind up thinking about how to represent the policy in a more compact form. And to be able to do it, one way you can think of doing it is to say you have knowledge about how the world evolves, okay, So you keep track of the state of the world. You, the agent, keeps track of the state of the world. It has some idea of how the world evolves when it's not looking at the world. And it has some idea about what its actions will do to the world when it does those actions on the world. Okay? And then, it, of course, it has goals. So then it can, basically using the sensors and this information, it can first decide what is the world like right now. Now, it's not as simple a question as you might think. You know, it's not just enough to say, take a picture of the world and that must be exactly what the world is, because the world can be partially observable. When it is partially observable, the true state of the world might be much more than what you're actually able to see, much different from what you're actually able to see. And my example, for those of you who have taken 471, you know, that my simple example for that is the blind spot in the car. When you're driving, right, you can't just assume that you know exactly what's happening behind you by looking at the rearview mirror. That's just only part of the information. And there can still be things in your blind spot. Now, of course, you can keep, you know, spastically moving your head back to see whether there is somebody in your blind spot. But you also can keep track of what's going on behind you. Okay, so basically you keep track of the road behind you for the last several seconds, and you have some understanding of how the world evolves. You kind of, unless you are near Area 51, you know that cars don't fall from the sky. So if there is a car suddenly, you know, if there is no car for the last several minutes behind you, then it could not be in the blind spot. Okay, last several minutes back, let's say you looked around and you had nobody in the blind spot, and then in the next few minutes, you know, you haven't seen any car in the rear view mirror, so there can't be any, you know. Or for example, you saw one, but you saw it pass by. So all of this reduces sensing by using knowledge, in essence, right? So that part, figuring out what the world is like now, is like right now, is a problem only when you have partial observability. Right? If you have full observability, by definition, you take a snapshot of the world, you know exactly what the world is right now. Right? To the extent, so this particular problem is called the state estimation problem. A state estimation problem. So you're trying to estimate the true state that the agent is trying to estimate. What its true state is. And it is a non-trivial problem. It's not just, you know, oh, it must be the union of the sensor readings. It's not. It's more than the union of the sensor readings, because it has to take into account the way the world evolves over time to actually truly reconstruct the state. Okay? To the extent this problem has a name, you know actually that more realistic scenario is for a robot to be in a partially observable world. I didn't have to tell you this, but you sort of, you know, probably guessed it before. Okay, in a fully observable world, this box doesn't make any sense. Okay, at least, I mean, it's a trivial box. The next one is, what will it be if I do an action? Okay, so you are actually looking, you know, by the way, I may not remember, but when I say you, most of the time, I mean your agent. The software agent that you're trying to write. Okay, so it basically needs to have a repertoire of actions, and then it basically has to see, well, I want, if I were to do this action, where will the world be? If I were to do this action, where will the world be? That's predicting what happens without doing the action. Okay, now once you have this information and you have goals, you can then do mental simulation. You can think in your mind and say, well, you know, I am in this state. I have these four actions. If I do that, I'll come here. If I do that, I'll come here. If I do that, I'll come here. Okay, now I have a goal which basically can be thought of as a property of a state. It takes a predicate, you know, it takes a state as input and then says yes or no for the simplest scenario. So my idea is to find a path to a state which satisfies my goals. Okay, so that picture essentially drew this mental picture for you. Here is my initial state. Somehow I spent a lot of time and figured out my initial state using state estimation, let's say. And then using my knowledge about how actions work on this world, I figured out what states can I get into. And now I have some goals for, you know, it's basically, imagine that I have some test, is goal test, and I can apply to each of these states. Remember, I'm doing this all in my head. I'm not working in the real world. Okay, so I can ask myself, is any of these goals? If so, I'm done. If not, I still need to continue my mental simulation of the world. The question then is, how do you do this mental simulation effectively, efficiently? And that's what A-star search and the related search algorithms all tell you. Basically, A-star search is a way of organizing the simulation to find a path from where you are to one of the goal-satisfying states in the fastest, in the most efficient way possible. And typically, A-star search also talks about the notion of optimality, which is that there may be many, many different ways of reaching a goal state. Okay, remember that if I went from here to here, there are actions here. This is A1, this is A2, this is A3, this is A4. So when the agent is doing actions, it is actually expending physical resources. Okay, and it can actually assume that these actions have costs. Maybe this is 5 units costly, this is 7, this is 3 units, this is 2 units. And one idea is to find a path to a goal-bearing state that has the lowest cost. That's exactly what A-star search tries to find. Okay, now for A-star search to have worked this way, for example, the big thing, now A-star search, I said, is for deterministic worlds. What part here is deterministic? Where in this picture did I say determinism? Yes, sir.
The next state.
Next state. So when I did A1, I got S1. I didn't get multiple different states, I got just one state. Okay, had it been the case that, let's say, this, you know, this robot actually has one more action, A5, if you do that, it can get into one of the states, S10, S11, S12. Okay, what that means is, when I do this action A5, I know something about the state that will happen. But I don't know it uniquely. I don't have a single name. I don't know that there's a single state that's going to happen. It could be one of these three states. If the agent thinks that it can be any of these three states and doesn't know anything further than that, then you consider this to be a non-deterministic action. It's a non-deterministic action, right? Okay, because if I do this action, I know 5 things can happen. Okay, but I don't know how much. I mean, so what's the least amount of knowledge about your actions? Let's actually play this game. What's the least amount of knowledge you can have about your actions? You don't even know what your actions are. You know, have you seen any kids? They are just basically pressing everything. Right? Because they're just checking out all sorts of actions, pressing everything, trying to eat everything, you know, contorting themselves to taste everything, because they came into the world with a few small, you know, minor effectors, and they're just figuring out what the actions are available. That's the least amount. Next, you know the names of the actions, but you have no clue what happens. You know, the kid may have realized that if there is a button, you can press it. If there's a red object, you can kind of touch it. But the kid may not know that the red object happens to be like a range stove in operation. Putting your hand on it is not a smart idea, because they don't have a model yet. The first time they put it, they get a model very quickly. Okay? Either they learn the model of the action after doing it, or the, you know, parents would have told them, no, don't ever touch these kinds of places. Okay, so they basically, either way, somebody has to give you the model of the action. Okay, so now if a kid, if an agent thinks that I know that I have these actions, but I have no clue what they do, the way to represent that action is what? You do the action, the outcome is any of the states. That's the way to represent the action. Because after that, I have no clue means you can be in any one of the states that is allowed. If you are in a finite state space, that's just a finite number of states. If you're in an infinite state space, God help you. Right? Okay. Now, if now this kid is basically figuring out that, well, it's not all of these, you know, 1500 states, but I think when I do this action, only these three states will happen, S1, S15, S95. Is this kid more knowledgeable than the previous kid? Clearly, because this kid knows at least some states won't happen. Now, there can be an even smarter kid who then figures out that, hey, S1 is happening 30% of the time. S15 is happening 60% of the time. S19 is happening only 10% of the time. This kid has stochastic action. Do you see what I'm saying? Okay? So this is non-deterministic action. If I then point out, this is point, let's say this is 0.7 probability, or I don't know, whatever the numbers I said. This is 0.3 probability, this is 0.6 probability, this is 0.1 probability. Suddenly it becomes a stochastic action. I want you to understand that stochastic means more knowledge. As much as it looks like stochastic means you have less knowledge, you know, compared to deterministic, if the world is not deterministic, expecting determinism in your actions is just delusional. The most information you can get about a stochastic world is these probability numbers. The least information is anything can happen. Slightly in between is some of these five things can happen. Okay? Now, which problem would you think is easier to solve if you are given actions which are deterministic? If you are given actions, I mean, so I have, here is a clump of actions for your world. Those are all deterministic. Here's a clump of actions. Those are all non-deterministic. Here are a clump of actions that are stochastic for the same domain, same exact domain. And I'm going to ask you to take whichever clump you want, only one clump, okay? Then I'll be testing you. You know, when I give you problems, I will decide whether you get points or not based on whether you're able to solve it. Now, obviously, these tests are curved, right? Because if nobody could have solved it, then I cannot really, you know, make you pay. I mean, after all grading is relative grading, whether people say it or not, okay? If everybody is basically failing to solve problems and you also fail to solve problems and you just solve one problem, if everybody else failed at all, then you suddenly become like the winner. So my question is, which would you pick if you can pick either of these three clumps? Which would you pick?
So what's the difference between non-deterministic and stochastic?
That's what I was saying. Stochastic means I know the probabilities with which the states will occur. Non-deterministic means I know they occur, but I have no clue what probability is, nothing. I have no further information.
But you know it will go to multiple.
It can go to one of these three states. Yeah. Okay. First of all, I mean, nobody can be in multiple states, obviously. An agent has to be in a physical state.
Okay.
I mean, you can go into quantum mechanics.
So without the probability, that means non-deterministic.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so going back to clumps. Which clump?
Deterministic.
Easy enough. Now I'm off the deterministic. You came into the room after the deterministic clump has already been exhausted. Which would you pick? Non-deterministic or stochastic? How many people said stochastic? How many people said non-deterministic? And who is sleeping? Okay. So why non-deterministic?
It's easier.
It's easier, why?
You have less knowledge. So for the same argument that somebody used last class.
I want you to remember these things. Okay, I mean, essentially, if, you know, the way I set this example, you are better off taking non-deterministic action because there are fewer problems that can be solved using non-deterministic action. Think about the following thing. Suppose I have a bunch of non-deterministic actions and I say, come up with a plan that will, that's guaranteed to take you to state S15. The probability is zero that such a plan exists. Right? I mean, very low, not zero, but it's quite low. In fact, if every action is non-deterministic, you need to be very careful in designing the domain that somehow all the uncertainty vanishes, even with these non-deterministic actions. Okay, now, so in the case of non-determinism, actually one of the only way it can vanish is like in that the vacuum agent domain, where the only way the uncertainty vanishes is, in fact, you will go directly to the, I mean, so after doing actions, all the uncertainty vanishes and you're remaining, you're left with exactly the state, that's the goal state. So if your plan always takes you to the goal state, think of that as a strong plan. Somehow it reminds me of strong bad, but strong plan. Okay, a weak plan is one which sometimes takes you to the goal state. That means there exists at least one execution of this plan which might lead you in the goal state. It's probabilistic. If you have non-deterministic actions, all I can say is, okay, I have a strong plan, I have a weak plan, that's it. If I have a stochastic action, then I can also ask you, can you get me a solution which is 70% probable to reach the goal? I couldn't even do that in the non-deterministic case.
It couldn't occur.
I could not, right? Because this guy would basically say, I don't have to do it, out of syllabus. Because 70% probability, I have non-deterministic actions, how the heck can I tell? Whereas the rest of you who pick the stochastic actions actually have to solve that problem and try to see if there is a plan that will reach with 0.7 or higher probability. Okay, now of course, this is obviously again a perverse scenario where your life is being judged only based on the grades you get on this silly test. But if on the other hand, you are trying to decide what kind of effectors you wish you had to lead your life, overall life, okay, you obviously would want deterministic effectors if possible, if not at least stochastic, because non-deterministic effectors, you won't be here. I mean, your ancestors with non-deterministic effectors did not have kids, and so you won't be here. Okay? Yes, and yes. What?
Is there any difference between non-deterministic actions and actions having equal probability?
That's who wants to answer his question. This is a graduate class. So his question is there a difference between non-deterministic actions and actions with non-deterministic actions? That means all state, I don't know at all what probabilities of the state are, and states with equal probability. So his question is, could I not have assumed when I said non-deterministic that this is really just 0.333? That's a big assumption. When I say I don't know, you assume everything is equally likely. You decided to make that assumption. I didn't. Do you see what I'm saying? It's a very good question, by the way. Many people sort of equate semantically non-determinism to equiprobability. So in general, when there is a non-determinism, what are we saying really? I said you have more knowledge in stochastic and less knowledge in non-deterministic. What's the knowledge? So tell me, what is the knowledge? Give me a technical name for the knowledge I have. Yes, sir?
Probability distribution.
How many distributions can you write on three possibilities?
Many.
What?
Many distributions.
How many?
Infinite.
Okay? When I said I don't know the distribution, I meant infinite number of possible distributions. I did not tell you which one. And you chose equiprobable one, which is one of those infinite number of distributions. Now, there is a technical argument that can be made that if you are anyway stuck with a probabilistic planner, it won't run unless there are numbers. You see what I'm saying? You need to feed it something, otherwise it won't run. Okay? And so you had to assume away this non-determinism and pick some distribution. So you pick 0.333, 0.333, 0.333. And this guy picks 100. That guy picks 010. That guy picks 0.5, 0.2, 0.3. Of all these people, you did the least amount of additional knowledge added to the problem. Because another technical way of saying it is, uniform distribution over n outcomes is the highest entropy distribution. any other distribution is lower entropy than the uniform distribution. For n, that is for, you know, finite number of possibilities. Right? Okay? So that's why people wind up picking the uniform sometimes. But you should know that, you know, that basically there you're just making an assumption. I didn't give you that knowledge. And you didn't learn it either. And so you're just assuming away. When you're assuming, you better be careful as to how seriously are you assuming, the, you know, how you know, loaded your assumptions are about the world. Yes?
So what I don't get is when you have non-deterministic, you can try it out and measure the probability. What, I mean, how can it happen in real life?
Right, okay. So just keep that question. It'll be answered in a minute, okay? But start thinking about who gave you the model. But, you know, we'll talk about it in a second. How did this actually move on? Okay. So, yeah. So, I need information about what my actions do. That information would be things like this. Right? That information would say, if you do action A1 in state S15, you will get state S19. That's an information about an action. The representation for actions is like this. Here is S1 to Sn. Here is S1 to Sn. An action is just this matrix. What do? You put zeros and a 1 and zero zeros. So each row has at most one 1. Then it's a deterministic action. So basically the semantics is, this is action A7, let's say. All I'm saying is if you do action A7 in S1, I will get S7. That's the definition of actions, right? That's basically the atomic description of the action. Now, the problem with this description is every action is just equally sized, right? So if your world has a billion states, every action is a billion by billion matrix. And you can write, you know, algorithms based on, you know, how to code matrix. Right? Okay. But what if you could write more compact representations for this matrix? And that's basically where something like the propositional or the factored representation comes in. So here I just said that the number of states are S1 to Sn. Those are the actual states. I didn't tell you what's inside those states. They're just black boxes as far as you're concerned. And the interconnection between the states is explained to you only in terms of which state do you get to from which state using which action. Now before I go forward further, one question is, if this were to be a stochastic action, what do I need to do? What? Exactly. So basically, this should sort of add to 1.0. Okay, so it doesn't have to be 1s and 0s. So I can just say this is 0.3, this is 0.7, it will become 1.0. If it is a total action versus partial action, that means if you want to talk about actions, which when you do it in a state, they don't actually execute. How do you write that in this description? Well, everything is zeros in that row. Now the question then is, semantically, what happens when you did the action that you're not supposed to do? I mean, because the point is, suppose, so bear with me here. So I have an action which has all zeros in S1 row. Okay. So A7 cannot be done in S1 at all, according to my description. But do you have to listen to me? No. I mean, did you not? I mean, you know, according to various religions, apparently none of you listen to not eating the apple, right? And so nobody listens to any direction. So you will try this action anyway. So what happens if when you try that action?
You should have said the same thing.
What?
You should have said the same.
If you want to do that, then you must have put a 1 here. Then there's no problem. In that case, in your world, every action is a total function. That means it, for every state, it tells you what state it gets you into. Okay? But if your actions have preconditions, you also heard, I mean, you know, those of you who have taken 471, you can think of actions in factor representation, you can think of actions having preconditions and effects. And the preconditions are an effect. Preconditions and effects are in terms of the state variables. So suppose my world has state variables v1, etc. up to vk, and make it simple and assume they're all Boolean. Okay? So then you really have 2 power k states that are being compactly represented by the different valuations over these states. Right? Okay, so now if I'm thinking in this description, then I'm thinking in factored representation. It's no longer this representation where states are black boxes. I'm in a factored representation. Okay, and in this factored representation, I need to write an action description. I can always go back here. Okay, so even though I have a factored representation, I can still write my action as a 2 power k by 2 power k matrix. How many of you think that's a stupid idea? If you're still awake. What? No, so basically I went here to do reasoning over states in a, you know, in a factored form, that when time came to represent the action, I represented it anyway in the ground level, in the atomic level. Do you think it's a smart idea? No, I'm asking a slightly different question, which is, if I have this representation of the world, you can still write the actions this way. And basically what I'm driving at is, I showed this picture last class, and I said, you solve everything first at the atomic level to understand that you understand how to solve the problem. And then you can try to solve it in the factored level, relational level, first order level. One cute thing, one actually perverse thing actually, not really cute, is you can decide for syntactic sugaring, you can decide to represent the states and the world in the factored form, but when time comes to solve the problem, you run back and solve it here. So you write your programs in supposedly high-level languages called Python. When time comes to solve it by Intel, what does Intel do? Does it have a Python interpreter? No, it just basically throws the whole thing into an assembly language. So this idea is you let the representation be done at higher level so that people feel good about representing the actions, providing information about, you know, the action. But then when the time comes to do reasoning, go back to ground level. Okay? Now, I want you to understand that as stupid as it might sound, actually this is a state of art in many cases. The ground algorithms actually might wind up doing better than the algorithms that run at this level because we are not yet smart enough to devise good algorithms here. Long back, before you guys, some of you were born at least, there used to be this direction in computer architecture called heavily microcoded machines. How many of you have heard of this thing called Lisp machine? Yeah, see, goodbye. So you're, at least there are some people who are old enough, you know, to understand my references. So Lisp machine essentially directly ran Lisp. It had hardware level support for Lisp. It's not around anymore. And we can ask, actually, we can talk all sorts of interesting questions as to why it went away. But that's the kind of thing. If you really believe that Lisp programs are, you know, it's better to write programs in a higher level language, you can have that belief and still assume that the program, the reasoning should be done in the ground level. And that's what happened in Lisp machine situation, because Lisp is now run on, any of the programs are run on RISC architecture. Right? Okay, but what's interesting is there are, you know, so in the case of the same thing happens in the agent design, you might have a propositional representation for the agent, but its internal algorithms, before they actually solve the planning problem, before they do the state estimation problem, they quickly convert everything into ground level. So the question then is, who are we impressing? If I had to, if I wrote my my knowledge about the world in this higher level, but whenever push comes to shove and I actually have to reason with it, I throw it down to the lower level, who are we impressing? Are we impressing anybody? Or are we deluding ourselves? That goes back to a question I think one of you had as to who is giving these actions? Who is giving these representations? So there are two possibilities. I told you this. For the kid's case, where did the kid figure out what actions do? Either the kid learned the hard way by plonking the hand on the red stuff, or the kid was told. Okay, now it's clear to you, it should be clear to you, that it must be easier to talk to a kid who understands language as against only understands, you know, primitive guttural sounds. Because the maximum you can do is whenever he tries to do something bad. And that is basically saying, that's a bad state, that's a bad state, that's a bad state. And you would be old before the kid actually figures out how many bad states are there in the world. Whereas if the kid starts understanding language, we provide higher level advice. Do you see what I'm saying? And to the extent the kid understands the language, then they have in one fell swoop got a lot more information. It's easy for the mother and father, and it's sort of easy for the kid to take it in. The kid doesn't need a huge storage space to put these actions now. Do you understand what I'm saying? So the point about higher level representations is twofold, and we tend to assume that they have to go together hand in hand, but in fact they sometimes don't go hand in hand. So people actually might use higher level representations but lower level reasoning. Okay, classic example that we'll talk about in this class, in fact, is pretty much everything in Markov addition processes. We will talk about factored representations for MDPs, but we will talk about how the actual search might wind up getting done in atomic level. In planning, for the longest time, there was single agent deterministic planning. For the longest time, people would use these sort of more high level representations for actions and which have preconditions and effects. Now coming back here, the action A7 might say, I can only be done if V1 is equal to true and V2 equal to false, at which point I will make V19 true. Ready or not, I'll make V19 true. That's the definition of A7. How large would it be if you were to write it in the matrix form? Just as big as the matrix. In fact, there is no difference in the sizes of the actions in the extensional form. Whereas you might think an action like this is sort of simpler than, I hope people can see it here, another action, A77, which says if V1 equal to true, or whenever V7 equal to true, V5 is also false, then my effects are either I would put V19 true, I will put V19 true, and if before me V25 is already true, then I will give you V37 true. I made this action up. It would make sense in some random world with, you know, these state variables. It looks as if this is a more complicated looking action than this. You write it extensionally, they are exactly the same size, 2 power k by 2 power k matrix. The reason you believe that these kinds of actions might work is if the world you live in did not have these kinds of actions, you wouldn't be here taking this class. Can somebody explain what I just said? I'm saying, if in fact you don't have, if your world doesn't have actions that are simple enough to write like this, there is something about this compared to, let's say, this, okay, then presumably you wouldn't have been here, evolutionarily speaking, not just your lifetime speaking. Because think about it this way, the harder actions like this essentially are saying each action might depend on all the variables and change all the variables. If you lived in a world where every action depends on every variable of the world, every attribute of the world, and changes every attribute of the world, we would be dead and gone long back. We have very small brains. I mean, as big as we think our brains are, they're pretty small. So in the world that we live in, obviously there is locality. The question is, can you exploit the locality? Can you write the representation? The fact that you are here is a living proof that there is locality to be exploited in the world. There are a few actions which may have very far-reaching effects, which is why, in fact, we even talk about actions with far-reaching effects, as if those are the abnormal kind of actions. Most actions have very local effects. Local means they just seem to affect a few state variables. If your world is like that, this representation can exploit that. This couldn't care less. It will write every action as a 2 power k by 2 power k matrix. You see that? Okay. So the point is that when you are thinking of higher level, when you're thinking of higher level representations, part of what you are doing is you're thinking that there is structure to be exploited in the world in which your agent is living. And you want to then devise languages that can exploit that structure. And then write algorithms that can possibly use that structured representation. The second part doesn't have to be going hand in hand with the first part. Okay? You may decide to write representations that use the structure of the world, but then when time comes to do reasoning, you might decide to go down to a lower level because you don't have any better idea. Another thing that you will notice is that from an algorithmic point of view, algorithms for this level and even further are much more ugly looking from a computer scientist point of view. How many of you, I mean, you all did binary trees versus height balance trees, AVL trees. Which would you rather have me give you as a homework for tomorrow? Write a binary tree code or AVL code? Binary tree code. Who the heck cares that AVL is the right way to live? Right? Binary trees are easier to write. Okay? So it turns out that these algorithms are, these will never be easier to write than these. But one of the things we have to understand is the enterprise of AI is not to make your life easy, the programmer's life easy, but to come up with more flexible agents, which are more efficient. AVL trees still exist, even though there are so many lazy people here who wouldn't want to write an AVL tree code, because there are some non-lazy people who have written library code. Right? And similarly, there could be non-lazy people who will figure out how to do efficient reasoning of these higher level representations. They would be more hairy. We will look at it in the context of, so for example, from the A star search point of view, those of you who remember 471, remember, compare A star search on one hand and planning algorithms on the other hand, the STRIPS oriented planning algorithms, STRIPS based planning algorithms. That was a separate chapter and that seemed to be sort of, you know, slightly more hairy. But it was, those were the algorithms that were designed to exploit the structure present in the STRIPS operator. Okay? And similarly, we will talk, you know, today onwards about Markovization processes, which is a more general agent architecture. Now notice that Markovization processes versus A star search is orthogonal to this plane. Do you understand that? Okay, you can have MDPs in atomic, propositional, relational, first order. You can have A star search in atomic, propositional, relational, first order. And you can also, so basically it's a different level, which is essentially about, you know, what sort of, it's the MDP versus A star search is what kind of assumptions you are making about the agent's effectors and sensors and the goals. And this is about what kinds of assumptions are you making in your program as to the input and output representation. These are two different things. You care about both, but one comes from externally. One comes internally. These things you get to write programs on. So if you chose to solve this representation in this form, that's because you're just lazy. Okay. So I already told you that, you know, A star search versus planning is atomic versus propositional. Okay. MDPs, we'll talk about atomic MDPs for the next several classes, and then also spend a couple of classes on factored methods. It turns out that, you know, A, it's actually a much hairier algorithms, and B, it's not, there is no consensus yet as to what's the best factored algorithms for Markov addition processes. One of the interesting things is everybody seems to agree what's the best assembly language. There's no street fights on Intel assembly language versus Motorola assembly language, partly because Motorola sort of disappeared. But, you know, there used to be a time when in this university, when you get into computer science, you can go into the Motorola assembly language course or Intel assembly language course. But no big deal, really. On the other hand, there are religious battles being waged on C++ versus C# versus Python versus Lisp versus, you know, whatever else, you know, CAML, OCaml, all these things. Now, why is that, why are there religious fights there and none in the assembly language? Because each of the higher level languages makes different kinds of assumptions on what kinds of structure people would like to write about and exploit in their programs. Assembly language says, I will support everybody, just as badly. I have no, you know, favorites. Do you see what I'm saying? Okay? So similarly, there are many more algorithms here which are reasonable algorithms compared to here. Again, this cross-cutting, this is nothing to do with any single topic. This is like one of the ideas that you have to, you know, realize to be sort of a mature researcher in AI. Because these things you'll keep seeing under different guises. A third example, forget about MDP and A-star search. Many of you know Bayesian networks. Some of you know Bayesian networks, hopefully. Bayesian networks are what level? What? Okay, so how many people think Bayesian networks are propositional level? Okay. How many people think Bayesian networks are something else? How many people don't care? So the rest of you have no clue. Is it because you are non-deterministic or you have a different answer? What? Oh, so you don't know. That's fine. But some people know Bayesian networks. What? I did write it too. Oh, well, what can I do? Okay, I'm not reading my slides. Okay. Well, at least somebody's reading. Okay, fine. So those of you who thought that Bayes networks are somehow atomic representations, they're not. They're propositional representations. Okay? Now, should you stop at the propositional representations? No, you don't have to. You can do relational representations. There are PRMs, which is like all the rage, you know, which is probabilistic relational models. Are structured probabilistic models. And in fact, there's this one workshop that is very well attended in AAAI and IJCAI these days, called the STAR AI workshop. And it's like structured representations for probabilistic knowledge. Okay? So, now the interesting question then is, in fact, one of the most interesting things, those of you who took 471 with me, I mean, I don't have it here, but you remember that, you know, you can talk about logic and probability. Logic can be done at the propositional, predicate, first order. You can do the same thing for probabilistic reasoning. You can do it at the propositional, predicate, first order, except we don't quite know how to give proper semantics to first order probabilistic logic as yet, which is why it's a hot area. Okay, another interesting thing is structured, even if you do relational probabilistic models, most algorithms for doing inference on relational probabilistic models essentially compile the reasoning task into a propositional probabilistic model reasoning. If you actually read this, and we might do it here too, but essentially they do compilation approach. They don't do direct lifted reasoning. Again, the same point. You can stick to the representation at a higher level and yet do reasoning at a lower level. And for some reason, now that we have done all this, I want to ask another question. What representation? What's the lowest representation Again, this is a graduate class. If you have never heard of AI, as I said, you will just pick it up, you know, because you decided if you are here, especially if you are here next week, that's because you decided you're going to pick it up. Okay. For the rest of you, I assume you know something already. Okay. But for those of you who already know something, my question is, you may have known machine learning algorithms, you know, because it's like, that's what everybody is talking about these days. How many machine learning algorithms, what's the lowest level of representation? I mean, here the lowest level is atomic, propositional, and so on. So this is the highest, this is the lowest, right? What's the lowest level machine learning algorithm do you know? So my question is, do you know any atomic machine learning algorithms? Machine learning algorithms that work at atomic representation. If so, that's the lowest level. If you don't know any atomic level machine learning algorithms, then the next would be propositional. And then the next would be relational. Then the next would be first order. So what's the lowest level you know? No, don't give me names. Again, this, basically I want you to think of patterns right now. You know. By the way, this class, I hope at the end of the whole semester, you go back, and I'm recording this, hear it again. And it should all be, because I would have repeated many of these themes multiple times, it should be, hopefully, you know, repetition and obvious to you. But I'm expecting, you know, more maturity than might be actually available in a, you know, even if you're just taking a second course in AI. Okay, so I'm asking, do you know of any machine learning algorithms that work in atomic level? Okay, let's track names. Decision trees. What level does it work? Here is another theory I have, which is the way you understand anything is, of course, not to sleep in the class, and then B, try to connect it to the other things you know. That's the only way you learn. And I have this, you know, picture in my head that little facts can just fall through the cracks. Clumps and clumps of facts, they're harder to fall. So connect everything and then, you know, you would have a bigger knowledge. So my question is, you know, I just told you, I'm asking this question, and you know that you now can look at algorithms, machine learning algorithms in this different aspect in terms of first order relational, propositional, atomic representations of the knowledge that they learn and that they start with and learn. My question is, if you take decision trees, is it, what level is it? Propositional. So the decision tree is propositional. Decision tree is not the lowest level. How about naive-Bayes classifier? Huh? I mean, many of you, I know, are in machine learning, writing papers in it. So I know your names, and so you should know these answers. Right? Naive-Bayes classifier? Propositional. Because the other name for propositional is attribute. Attribute-oriented learner. Right? Anything else you can think of that's not propositional? What? How about SVM? All of them are propositional.
If this, then that.
What?
If this, then that.
That's not the, I understand, but I'm basically, my question is, do you know of any learning algorithms that work in atomic level? And this is actually a pretty deep question, it turns out. No, they are not learning algorithms. They are just different. They are basically inference algorithms on atomic representation. Okay, let me ask the following question. Suppose you live in an atomic world. What do you want to learn in that world? So, here is a class. There is no representation for any of you other than your social security number. That's atomic number. That is basically atomic representation of all you people. You may think you have lots and lots of properties. To heck with those properties. We'll just give you a number. That number represents the whole of you. Now tell me what you want to learn in this class. You may want to learn who are likely to, you know, get an A+, because maybe you want to copy their homework. Right? How do you learn it?
You can't hold on to the information.
Basically, the thing that I want you to remember, understand, and think in the background, there's very little you can do to learn in an atomic world. This is a great strike against atomic representation. This is a lovely strike about atomic representations, right? If I did not tell you carefully, you know, all the connections between the states, there is nothing you can learn, really. The whole point of learning is generalization. Right? So you want to say, okay, this number, okay, number blah blah blah, got an A plus, seems like an A plus kind of a candidate. So what do I learn from this? I know that this number is an A plus. You already are given that. What you want to know is, hey, this number guy has the following properties. Seems to have long hair, really big glasses. Maybe people with long hair and really big glasses get A plus. That's a hypothesis. You can't even say that hypothesis if you only have social security numbers. Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, it's not a question of is it the right or wrong hypothesis. You have no language to represent hypothesis. All you can learn is this number, A plus. And then after a long time, you will find out, you know, posthumously this other number is A plus. Okay, is that also A plus? So learning doesn't seem to occur at all in atomic representation. This is a great way to understand why one needs higher level representations, even if you don't mean to do reasoning there. Right? You might try to learn the representations and then do the reasoning at the atomic level. Right? Now, having... Wow, that's very nice. I think you're in the wrong class. So my question then, now I want to kind of mess with your mind, brains. I mean, if I haven't done enough of it already. We have until 4:15, right? Okay. So, what if I were to tell you that there actually is learning that can be done? There is non-trivial. So first of all, there is learning that's going on with social security numbers, right? You just learned that social security number 7895 9897 A plus. The problem is the learning doesn't go above the data. How many of you think somehow this can be handled by nearest neighbor search? People, somebody said nearest neighbor search. Where do you get neighbors? To be able to talk about nearest neighbors, you have propositions, you have attributes, you have dimensions. Do you understand what I'm saying? There is no space in which, I don't know what space you guys live in. I just have a number for you. So the only learning that can happen in atomic level is the trivial learning, which is, if you told me, don't have to tell me again the same exact fact. But if that's the only learning we were capable of doing, once again, you won't be here taking this class. Because your ancestors wouldn't have had kids and you wouldn't have been born. You see what I'm saying? The life is just too short. Human life is too short to learn every bad state, every good state in terms of its state descriptor. You had to go higher level reasoning. Right? So now, having made you be all, you know, gung-ho about higher level reasoning and that machine learning cannot even be done in anything other than higher level representations, yeah, if I were to tell you that there is actually non-trivial learning that can be done, non-trivial learning that can be done in atomic level, wouldn't you be surprised? At least to humor me? Because I just made you think otherwise, and you should be surprised. Reinforcement learning, which we will be discussing, essentially allows to talk about non-trivial learning at atomic level. Because here is the interesting thing, when you have sequence, when, if I just told you these are all the social security numbers of these people and nothing more, and here is a, you know, couple of data points about people with A pluses and people with C minuses, there isn't a whole lot you could go by. If on the other hand, I were to tell you, here are all the state numbers, S1, S15, S25, etc. And here is, you know, me wandering around these states in the past. And I found that whenever I seem to start from this state and walk, I seem to be falling into a ditch, eventually. I may not have language to say it's a ditch. I just experience good pain. I mean, not good pain, okay? And then here is from this state, if I ever do bunches of actions, I seem to be feeling very happy. I can do learning. I can provide credit blame assignment and say, I know that some states, the whole thing about these atomic representations is, some states will give you immediate reward. The pain states will give you pain. Right? And the states where you got, you know, maybe like a morphine shot or something will give you happiness. The question is, can you see the state before that state and start realizing that that state also has some of these properties? When you do that, you essentially stop being one of these people who go to Grand Canyon and try to take a picture, you know, kind of standing on the edge and take me a picture, and then you'll take one more step and you fall off. They basically have not learned, even at atomic level. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because they should have realized that the state where they're standing, while that seems to be nice and happy, the state after that, people seem to be screaming. And the way the states are defined after and before is how? The actions you can do. The neighborhood of states is the actions you do. Reinforcement learning is trying to teach you which states will eventually get to bad outcomes, which states will eventually get to good outcomes. Everybody can tell when they got a huge, big, you know, gunshot wound on their head that, you know, they must be bleeding right now. The issue is to be able to tell the five states before where you still have ability to choose your actions, that I'm getting dangerously close to being in a state where I'll feel a lot of pain. Do you understand what I'm saying? When I do this, I still don't know what are the, you know, propositional representations of these states. I'm thinking in terms of numbers of these states. S15, I'm not immediately feeling any pain, but based on my, you know, my previous experience, you know, if I'm not careful, I'll feel a lot of pain. That's non-trivial learning. Do you understand what I'm saying? So even learning actually can be done in atomic level, but only reinforcement learning makes sense at atomic level. And every kind of learning can be done in the other level. Yes?
Haven't you changed the question from what you asked before, though?
What is the question? Oh, tell me.
The question that you asked before when you asked about machine learning algorithms were, you have a set of social security numbers for people and an instantaneous snapshot, and you have a set of grades that are assigned to them. Can I learn from them?
Mm-hmm.
But the question you're asking now is, now we have the atomic states and all of the links.
Actually, so here is the interesting question. Okay, so here's the point. I did not actually say, when I asked you, do you know any atomic learning algorithms, as to how the learning algorithm is defined. After all, reinforcement learning is also learning algorithm. Okay, I talked about the examples and the labels only when I was talking about decision trees, which, because that's the only thing they can do.
Sure, but you could make a decision tree based on, like, me as a for all of us as children, you can make a decision tree based on all of the states that we went through to get to an A, right?
Yeah.
So
those are not decision trees. That's reinforcement learning.
Right.
Okay. Sure. So decision trees essentially are asking questions about properties of states. The decisions being made in the decision tree is not, is your state name this? Because those would be pretty useless decision trees. They're asking, is your state red? If so, go this side. If it is blue, go this side. Now, if it is red as well as hot, go this side. Otherwise, go this side. That's, you know,
proposal. But isn't the state, the other state that a given state links to, isn't that a property of the state?
My point is, who is doing the linking? In the decision tree learning kind of algorithms, we assume states just come out of nowhere, and they just, I mean, so the examples come out of nowhere, and they have labels. If you realize that these examples are actually states and you can go between them, then you can do non-trivial learning, even at atomic level. Now, just because reinforcement learning can be done in atomic level doesn't mean that we should all be doing atomic level learning. I'm just trying to make you think of, basically I'm branding your minds here today. That's all I'm going to do, okay? So I'm just trying to make you think, realize that learning actually occurs in propositional level for most of the learnings that you have thought of. And then I'm turning my plate and saying, actually, non-trivial learning can occur even in atomic level. That's reinforcement learning, which is actually why this class is in some sense much more conceptually satisfying than 471. Okay? It's still the same class. So now that the door is closed, that's basically what you do if you have black box representations of the state, you know. Okay, so the point is that I had actually a specific point to make, but obviously I forgot. Anyway, let me take your question.
Okay, I got lost when you were talking, suddenly jumping to states. You're talking about social security number and their grade.
Mm-hmm.
Right. How is that? What is the state?
So here is my, okay, so I'll give you two learning scenarios, okay? Here is a scenario where S1, 15, S15, minus 35, S19, plus 4. I don't know. These are just states. Okay? Now, can you do anything with this? These are the state numbers. What kind of learning can you do if you're doing the kind of what the decision trees, etc. do?
How does it represent social security number?
This is my social security number. I can write the number down here if you want. S1 is just the, you know, so here. I'll write it here. 7859786 15. It could be social security number. It could be state identifier. Okay? 4789 34 35 and 5 8 9 8 9 plus 4. My point is, if I give you a learning data like this, there's nothing you can do. There's no structure to it. So anyway, yeah, I remember what I was going to say. 471, as much as I love that course, and you know, seriously, I think it's a great course to take, is less conceptually satisfying in the following sense. We start for the inference at the atomic level, A star search, go to propositional level, strips planning, go to relational and first order level for at least logical representations, which is theorem proving. But the learning, we start at the decision trees. So with respect to this picture, everything else is going like this, but learning starts here, as if learning cannot be done at all ever in atomic level. In this class, we start with learning and at the atomic level too, because reinforcement learning can be done at the atomic level. Can it be done at the other levels? But of course, it can be done. So the non-trivial reinforcement learning can still be done at the atomic level. Okay, that's a very useful thing to know. Let me see if I can. Yeah, I want to go to this, but let me show you this slide and show the pendulum swing slide, and then so that at least next class we'll start talking about Markov decision processes, which is the first topic. So this is basically the contents of the intro to the Russell and Narvik textbook. The stuff in green is what I have done more or less of those chapters when I taught 471. So if you take, you know, if you look at my 471 videos online, they would basically explain to you all the things in green. The things in red I didn't touch. The things in brown I sort of maybe touched. At least that's at least one 471 aspect. Okay. And then the ones with these arrows are the things that this course is going to talk about. So you see there is some overlap, but also that you're talking about different topics in the textbook. So you can look at this if you want to make sense of what we'll be doing in this class. Okay? It still turns out, as I said, that you can understand this course independently of 471, but your appreciation might be higher if you also know the 471 material. Somebody once, how many of you know Reduced Shakespeare Company? What? Reduced Shakespeare Company. So these are people who, also, if you're sticking in this class, grow old fast, okay? Because most of my references are from old times. You might anyway grow old, but that's a different story. Reduced Shakespeare Company. I would not even. Does anybody remember this guy's spelling? I don't know. Let's assume. Okay, company. Okay. That is essentially another version of this is Dave Barry Slept Here. a sort of history of United States. Okay, either you know Google on the YouTube or check on the YouTube Reduce Shakespeare Company or Dave Barry Stepped here the book. Okay, these are great parodies on the real thing. And of course the tagline for Reduce Shakespeare Company is you can enjoy it just by itself, but the more you know the original, the better your enjoyment would be of this. Sort of like that for 471, 571 connection. You can do fine in 571 if this is the first time you are hearing about AI, as long as you have general intellectual maturity. But you know, some of the connections I'm making would make a lot more sense for people who may have been already in 471. Okay, so that's about this slide. The other thing I wanted to actually touch on, and then we can use this as the basis for the discussion on the on the piazza, is basically there's a bunch of so the stuff that we have talked about in the previous slides is essentially what are the aspects of agent design, and and as I said, the atomic propositional, et cetera, is how you organize your program in terms of which language you write it in. And the other part is what assumptions are you making about the agent. And that black box diagram is your assumptions on the architecture of the agent. Okay. This is AI as a scientific enterprise. Basically, people, follow trends. Everything follows trends. And it's kind of interesting. It's not, that's not the main thing. As far as you're concerned, you should just care about what's working right now. But however, what's working right now may be too myopic, because as I said last time, there are certain things that people are not working because they don't work anymore. So then you don't need to know about them, even though they are not being published in IIII and IIHCAI. There are certain things that people are not working on, not in large numbers, not because they are not going to work, but because they are hard to actually find algorithms for. They're very useful problems that people just don't know how to do yet. Okay, so, and in terms of that, it's kind of useful to look at these pendulum swings. This is my caricature. I'm old enough to know this. Some of you, may or may not know this, but obviously, you can read up or ask questions on Piazza and we can discuss this. One big trend, let's say from like old time versus now, where old can be decided as 80s, 90s versus now. Okay, is top down versus bottom up. So most papers, if you open like a IIHCAI 85 kind of a paper, most papers will start thinking of start thinking of what happens in these boxes without caring about what's coming, without caring about the bottom up aspect. Okay. So when I have all the information, I'll do all this great planning, I'm ready. Now with the planning algorithms, let the knowledge come. And in fact, there's a classic problem then of environment comes unwashed in its sensory information. This is mostly numerical probabilistic information. Most of the work that was being done here was logical approaches. And so there is this problem called pixels to predicates problem. How do you go from sensory information to the higher order representational primitives? That's the interface layer in some sense. For this, so you start working from top, hoping that people will build up from the bottom. And people were sometimes building up from the bottom, hoping that people will come down from the top. Now, I call this top-down, bottom-up, but you can also call it basically two ends. Like imagine when the Transcontinental Railroad was made in US, somebody must have made sure that these two guys who met in Utah actually are going to meet in Utah. Otherwise, somebody will be in Wisconsin, somebody will be in Idaho, and then, I'm done. Okay, there is no connection between. Okay, so now the interesting thing is there's nothing wrong with some people working in top-down and some people working in bottom-up, but since people make these decisions by themselves, and of all the sociopaths of the world, researchers are the top quality. They don't particularly brook other researchers. Okay, so they pick the problem that is passionate, that they feel passionate about. Think of Andrew Wiles. The guy hung around in a closed room. Who is Andrew Wiles?
A mathematician.
And?
He solved the
Fermat theorem. How long did he take for it? Multiple years. Basically 10, 15 years, he just hung around in his attic and basically just worked on that problem, chipping away. There was no Google interest in that problem. There was no Yahoo interest in that problem. That was something that he cared about. Right? I mean, so talk about non-team player. Right? This guy, and also from my point of view, what a great university that they left him alone for like 15 years without any papers. Right? He had no papers for 15 years. But anyway, the point is, when people are picking whether to work top-down or bottom-up and independently, it's not necessary that 50% of them will work on top-down, 50% will bottom-up. People do herd mentality. Back in 80s, everybody was working top-down. Now, mostly everybody is working bottom-up. In between, there were people arguing that we should also do bottom-up in the back good old days. Now there are people arguing we should also do top-down. And you have to keep this in mind in understanding what's not said in a paper. Every paper is written as if that's solving the world's problem, the world's AI problem, I think is it. You know, but nobody is really solving the entire problem. The question is, what are you assuming away? Okay, the bottom-up guys in particular, for example, might just say data. You know, if you hear one more time that data is everything, that's a very bottom-up approach. Unless you have great machine learning algorithms that are actually able to compute patterns from the data and basically, you know, stratify it in multiple levels of knowledge and then use it. How many examples do you get in real life to figure out a concept? Humans. Very few. Human learning is knowledge rich, data poor. Current great machine learning success can be attributed to data rich, knowledge poor algorithms. It doesn't have to be that way. We may never be able to do data rich algorithms given our little brains. But we can develop algorithms that can do data rich and knowledge rich scenarios. That's worth understanding. Okay, so one of the questions is, very few machine learning algorithms actually allow structured background knowledge. They all start from the data many a time. There are great applications where that kind of technology seems to work, and so you all get jobs and you are happy. There's nothing wrong with it. But overall enterprise of AI has to consider the fact that, you know, the only intelligent beings around us seem to actually do a huge amount of knowledge-based reasoning. With one example, we'll quickly learn the concept, one very few examples. Okay? That's kind of one thing. The other is ground versus lifted representation. A lifted, essentially, ground means atomic or propositional. Lifted means predicate or first order. Typically, people tend to consider atomic propositional as kind of ground, although one is more ground than the other. And the predicate and relational and first order representations are typically considered higher level, lifted representations. Now, one of the interesting questions is, which level should you live in? Again, the pendulum has swung from lifted representations to ground representations. And again, people do it for a variety of reasons. You know, people work on things that are working. Okay, here is a great quote by Fernando Pereira, who is the director of Natural Language Processing Group at Google. And he said the following: the longer I live, the farther down the Chomsky hierarchy I seem to fall. And if you are a computer scientist, you should understand what the heck it is saying. Okay? The lower level algorithms is where people, lower level knowledge is where people are sticking around because they seem to work right now. But that doesn't mean that the other things won't work even better. But currently, that's where most of the work is going on. Okay? Pure inference versus pure learning versus interleaved inference and learning. Most of the work in AI used to be completely differentiated into, this is planning people. They just assume the models are given, and they only consider theorem proving on top of those models. These are learning people. They just come up with the models. They could care less about who is using those models. And they shall not talk much to each other. That's changing more. Okay, because it's now much more interesting to talk about, you get your own knowledge by learning and you use it. And when you learn the knowledge, it can never be complete. And you have to deal with incompleteness of your model, for example. Okay, knowledge engineering versus model learning versus data-driven inference. Original back 85 time frame, The answer to the question, who writes these action models? People do. People would just write them down and put it into the machine. That's knowledge engineering. In fact, there used to be a job description called knowledge engineer, who would then basically be trained to how to write knowledge in certain formats. Okay, some of them have now migrated to semantic web community. Okay, because they more or less do the same thing. You know, people should be writing whatever they know in RDF framework, using some rules about best practices about how to write things together. More and more people are caring also about, you should learn the model that you're going to use. And combining, and then when you're learning the model, the question is, you learn the model just one level from the given data, or are you going to use the data and the previously learned model to talk about more learning? The big buzzword now for doing the obvious thing is lifelong machine learning, as if there's supposed to be any other kind of machine learning. Now, the great thing about researchers is we'll solve the bad problem, and then when you go back to the right problem, we'll give it a new name so that it looks as if it's much fancier, you know, as again as saying we were solving the easier problem first. And then the last one is human-aware versus standalone versus human-driven. Yeah, I never really was very ambivalent about humans, first of all. Right? And of course, all the public depictions of AI are, who the heck are these humans? How do we get rid of them? Okay, but even in terms of developing systems, what are interesting research problems? We only cared about the, you know, previously we talked about this agent, that pink agent last time, and then I said what's missing in it, and most of you said, at least one of you said other agents, and I said other pink agents, and you didn't say anything. What about human agents in the middle? If there are human agents in the middle, for a while at least, then one of the very interesting questions would be that there are separate answers to some of the problems. Should machines have emotions? Who cares whether machines have emotions or not? If they can do good reasoning without emotions, that's fine. But should they understand emotions? They do. Imagine, you know, what was the reason that paperclip thing for Office 97 was such a flop? You know, imagine having like an assistant which basically doesn't know that when you kind of stub your toe, doesn't say, oh, that must hurt. Instead says, let's go to the next task. You get angry. You are irrational. You are not a machine. I understand. But since this machine has to work in your presence, we need to understand, machines need to understand human emotions. Of course, this is not completely new for you Star Trek fans. But, you know, for the rest of us, it could be new. Okay, and there's more and more work about taking, you know, humans in the loop and basically talking about what are the interesting research problems when humans are in the loop. You need to actually consider emotion recognition, affect recognition. If the same exact sentence, if I say it in a high-pitched voice versus a low-pitched voice, it means different levels of importance. Who decided this? We decided it. Somebody else who comes into the middle and wants to interact with us need to follow those conventions. And then the final thing, which is probably the most mind-boggling thing, is human-driven AI. Because in fact, you know, the biggest hot topic right now in certain areas is crowdsourced intelligence. Why? Because, as they said, the most ill-used piece of CPU in the universe is our brains. We barely use, according to various metrics, we have a lot of free time. And so if we can somehow use all these people to solve problems, that'll be great. Now previously, these people, to make them solve problems, you have to go to their homes and talk to them. Now, thankfully, they're all connected to the machine through the internet, and they have no other lives. So how do we exploit these guys to solve problems? And one of the interesting things is it looks as if crowdsourced reasoning has no connection to AI, because it's just humans working. But whenever you see a huge number of people working, there is a manager who is managing them. Who is this manager going to be? AI. You can have AI planners, AI reasoners, essentially direct what subtasks get given to these jobless people taking 571. And don't have a homework due, and so they're free. So how could you use them to do something useful? So that's one more pendulum. So So I'll stop here. Actually, both classes have just been about the background material on 571. Next class, the very first slide would be that, Markov addition processes.